Hello there. Some quick plugs to start out. You can follow the show on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. You can send email in at greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Follow the show on SoundCloud, Greetings from Allentown. Rate and review on iTunes. Subscribe. A 5-star review is always appreciated. And you can read my blog, which contains many musings on wrestling and life, at section309.com. And now, hit it.
The following wrestling exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Hello and welcome to episode 14 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winson, and today we are kicking it back to the really, really old school, going all the way back to February of 1980, the same month that Vince McMahon formally incorporated Titan Sports, and also the time of probably the biggest angle that Vince Sr. ever booked in his promotion. It is a story that has been told many times through the years, the protege turning on the mentor, and I don't think it's ever been told quite as well as the saga of Bruno Sammartino and Larry Zbysko. But first, a couple of things about this episode that I want to go into. I'm actually going to be breaking a couple of the informal rules that I've created for myself on this show. One thing that I'd like to do is I like to have complete episodes, and I do like to stick to the one-hour episode, so that's why you haven't seen me do a WCW Saturday night, because those are all two-hour episodes. I'd like to do more WCW in the future, but I kind of want to keep it to those 45-minute shows that were patterned out for an hour for television. One rule that I'm going to be breaking here is it's actually not the complete episode. There are two matches missing from this episode of Championship Wrestling on YouTube, and one of them does feature Hulk Hogan going against Angelo Gomez, which I don't think we're missing a whole lot there, because later on there's a Hulk Hogan handicap match where he faces Angelo Gomez and some other guy that is out there, so I don't really feel like we need to see Hulk Hogan in January of 1980, although it is an interesting look because of how green he was. You could kind of see where it was going, and he did make some strides in 1980. Of course, had the match against Andre the Giant at Shea Stadium and other matches against Andre, and in fact had some decent matches with Bob Backlund, including one at the Philadelphia Spectrum later in the year that was fairly good Hogan for that time period. Also missing is Bobby Duncombe versus Steve King, and I'll cycle back to Steve King at some point because he was a jobber's jobber for the time period. And Bobby Duncombe, of course, the father of the Bobby Duncombe who you would come to know in the West Texas Rednecks of 1999 WCW. So that's one rule that I'm going to be breaking here. The other one is I usually don't want to go too far outside the episode that I'm covering, but in the case of Bruno and Larry, this is such a special angle, and it's not right to talk about everything that went into the build to this without playing stuff from the previous several weeks on Championship Wrestling, because they very, very carefully built up this match, and they did it in such a brilliant way, which I will be getting into a little bit later on. Now, my view of the WWF from this time period has evolved over the years in kind of my different stages as a fan. When I was a kid, I would rent the Coliseum videos, and of course, the Bruno Larry match is something that I originally saw, having rented Best of the WWF Volume 1. Which means I'm kind of surprised that this is available on YouTube, given that it was on a Coliseum release, and those tend to get blocked, but it got through, so that's all I could really ask for. And the way I used to look at the WWF of this time period when I was a kid, I would kind of see, you know, oh, it's cool to see Bruno wrestling. You'd see, you know, this on like the old tapes, but you wouldn't, they wouldn't put too much pre-1984 stuff out there. So whatever I would see, it would, you know, kind of be cool to me as a little kid, but, you know, there really wasn't much of it to form an opinion. I just kind of saw somebody like Bruno or Backlund as mythical godlike figures because they weren't talked about too much, because I only started watching about the second that Bruno left as an announcer and they went into full-on burial mode and they were not going to acknowledge Bruno as the greatest champion the promotion ever had. And they weren't talking about Backlund either, because he went out the door too, didn't come back until 1992. So you have basically every champion they had, save Pedro Morales and the various transitional champions. And I guess superstar Billy Graham in there for a year. They did talk about him. But you had Bruno and Backlund from 1963 through 1983, the two dominant figures in the World Wrestling Federation. They didn't really talk about them all that much. So after a while, I just kind of made the determination, well, why should I pay any attention to this stuff? It's old wrestling. Oh, it's a little boring. It's kind of like this tiff that's been going on Twitter today as I record this between Randy Orton and Rip Rogers and Will Ospreay and all this other stuff about, quote, dive and that whole thing. I have to confess, I'm kind of on Team Orton in this case. You know, Will Ospreay can do the dive moves and whatever. It's perfectly fine. It's maybe not as much my cup of tea as it is everyone else's. But anyway, back to how my views have sort of evolved. We get into the Attitude Era, and, you know, as a late teenager and in my early 20s, I look at the old stuff and I say, these old farts, they're so boring, sitting around in chin locks the whole time. Just boring, boring, boring. This is where it's at. 3-minute matches and TNA and all that. Not TNA, but T and A. you know, this is where it's at. And I look back and I often refer to myself as a stupid 12-year-old. Well, I was a plenty stupid 19-year-old too, kind of looking at the Russo-rific stuff that was going on there. Although the guys at the tippy top, The Rock and Austin and Brett in his Hard Foundation run, those were top shelf kind of guys. And of course the promotion's always going to be good when the tippy top guys are of that caliber. But now in the last few years, I'm older, I'm wiser, unfortunately probably much more older than I am wiser, but in any event, I've come to realize that there is a great value to the stuff from pre-1984. And I really enjoy watching it. And the stuff from 1998 and 99, I hardly ever watch that stuff. I have not watched a single 1999 Raw from the network since, well, I guess I watched the January 4th, 99 Raw where Mankind won the title. But that was taped in 1998 and I was there. So I had a good excuse. I've not gone back and watched the Raw that I went to in late August at the Fleet Center in Boston where I guess the Rock and Sock Connection won the tag titles, because it's just wholly unmemorable. Mick Foley winning his first world title, yes, that was memorable, but a lot of that late 90s era is kind of suffering from the same issues that WWE has right now, where you have a bunch of stuff on pay-per-view, you have these good, quote, 3.5-star matches, but you hardly remember any of them after they happen. I mean, what's there to really remember? Like, the only thing I can even recall is, yes, there was a good Dolph Ziggler-Miz match, I think it was last October or whatever, and I remember Miz making a sad face against the ropes after he had lost the match. It's like, how many things can I possibly remember now? And I know that there was probably a lot of boring stuff in the week-to-week TV back in the Vince Sr. days, which is where we are in 1980, because Vince Sr. did not book a lot of angles. He was kind of running almost like an AWA style thing where it was a handful of big angles a year. But the thing is, you would actually remember these things when they happened. And they were done in such a way that made sense. And this Bruno Larry thing is just so beautifully put together. Even stuff like Backlund with the belt getting destroyed, which I covered in episode 7. The comedy of that is just fantastic. And Backlund's overreaction. I've just really enjoyed being able to watch this stuff. And we really are in a golden era right now where so much footage is available on YouTube. And you can watch whatever your pleasure. If you want to watch Will Ospreay versus Ricochet, knock yourself out. That's out there. You can watch that. You can watch anything really from the last 5 years. Indie promotions, they put all their stuff on YouTube. That's great. You can watch that. But I love watching the stuff from this early pre-rock and wrestling era. In fact, last week, part of it was preparation to do this show. I watched the Madison Square Garden card from January 21st, 1980. And there were a lot of interesting things on that show. You had Kevin Von Erich wearing boots, no less. Because, of course, Kevin Von Erich was the one who often, he was barefoot most of the time that you see him in his heyday in Texas. Wrestling against Johnny Rods in an odd, almost shoot-like match at Madison Square Garden. You had Backlund versus Ken Patera, and we're going to get into that in a little bit here because Patera kind of cuts a promo on what happened in that match. You have Pat Patterson taking on Lou Albano, which just sounds, you know, amazing. Hulk Hogan versus Dominic DiNucci. So much interesting stuff on that card. But that wasn't enough for me. I had to switch off of that and put on a Spectrum show featuring Dick Graham and Cal Rudman on commentary as only they can bring it at the old Philadelphia Spectrum from May of 1982, which had Bob Orton challenging Bob Backlund for the WWF title. And in the main event was a cage match between Tony Atlas and Jesse Ventura, which had a blood with both guys and had one of my favorite cage match finishes ever. And it's not like Atlas and Ventura were these great workers or anything. I just love the way they did the finish where both guys are out of it, but Ventura gets up first, starts to scale the cage, but spends too much time preening. So Atlas goes the other side and quickly climbs out of the ring in no time at all. And it was so brilliant because it perfectly protected Ventura, who was pissed off as all hell after the match, yelling and bleeding all over Cal and Dick at ringside. It was just fantastic. And there's so much of this gold that's out there now that you should watch. If you have the time, first of all, but it there's just a lot of comedy to be mined there. And of course, I owe, as I've mentioned several episodes ago, a lot of credit for kind of introducing me to that, to the podcast Titans of Wrestling, which stopped recording episodes in February. And I did lean on them a little bit. Some of their early episodes covered this time period in WWF. I believe it was episodes 9 and 10 on Titans of Wrestling. And you can find their playlist on SoundCloud, and I definitely recommend you check it out. And they covered all sorts of different areas, Portland and Georgia. And it's a great history of the business podcast. And it's probably, yeah, my favorite format of any wrestling podcast that's been done. I listen to a lot of them, but the format of four guys working in comedy and serious analysis in kind of a perfect balance, I just really enjoyed that. Now, there's gold on this show, so I probably shouldn't waste too much time. This may end up being a shorter show than some of the ones the previous weeks because there are not as many matches on this show. We have Ken Patera in action. We have Pat Patterson, who is still the Intercontinental Champion at the airing of this show, and we have the Bruno Larry match, and then having to follow that, although I don't know the exact taping order, we have Tony Atlas, Mr. USA, in action as well. This was actually taped January 22nd, 1980, aired February 2nd in the New York City market and in other markets. Other places, though, like Boston, were apparently 2 weeks behind. And that kind of makes me wonder, because you have such a big thing like Larry Zbyszko turning heel on Bruno Sammartino, how that would be worked. And I'll get into that in terms of what was going on with Larry during the time period when we get to the Bruno-Larry match. So let's just get right into the show, shall we? Before we get to the first match with Ken Patera, we have Patera and his manager, the Grand Wizard of Wrestling, at ringside to do a promo with Vince, which was the style at the time and just how they did things. And the Grand Wizard, if you're not familiar with him, he he had quite the interesting look. He was a diminutive Jewish man by the name of Ernie Roth, who also happened to be gay, who was wearing outlandish outfits, kind of like Fred Blassie, but also with a turban on his head, which sounds like a giant rib being played on him, but it was just part of the outlandish character that he was. Now, he is not quite as remembered as the other two of the three wise men who were the heel managers of WWF in the time period. Everyone knows Captain Lou Albano because he stuck around for many years after this. He retired the first time in 1986, but was involved in wrestling for years afterwards, and was famous for the whole Cyndi Lauper angle and all that. And Freddie Blassie was a manager at the first and the second WrestleMania, so people were very exposed to who he was. Of course, a famous wrestler in his own right, dating back to the 60s and 70s, the big feud with John Tolos that did record gates out in Los Angeles in 1971. But the Grand Wizard kind of lost to history, and it's for a tragic reason, as he passed away in October of 1983, So just before he would have been put on a much bigger stage, the Grand Wizard passes away. And one of the great things about going back and being able to watch this is to see him in action. And he has a very unique and fun promo style here. In this case, he's mocking Backlund for what happened at Madison Square Garden on January 21st, saying that he was going to do anything to save his title and that he ran into the referee on purpose. Well, the more truth to the matter is that Backlund got Patera in his big atomic drop, which was the finisher still at that point, 1980. Patera got a foot on the ropes and avoided getting pinned there. And they do a side headlock spot, and Patera throws Backlund off and into referee Jack Lotz in the corner, who sells it like he is down unconscious in the corner, head under the turnbuckle. Oh, his head might have hit the post. And what happens is Backlund and Patera continue going at it. Patera actually gets the full Nelson move on Backlund, who breaks it by running the ropes, not in the corner, but on the side ropes. And it almost looks like he wanted to flip him over into a pinning combination, i.e. the Bret Hart move. But that didn't work. He just kind of fell off there. And in any event, there was no referee there. You had a second referee come into the ring and just call for the bell. So it ended up being a draw. And I just love the way the Grand Wizard talks. He's just got such a great voice.
I have no great love for Patterson, but I do think he is a strong enough man, a big enough man to see that the rules are enforced. And if you want to know what your beloved Bob Backlund is worried about, he's worried that he can't run to the referee and say, "Stop the match, please. I don't care if I lose the match. I want to save my belt." This time it can't happen, Mr. Backlund. This time the strongest man in the world, Ken Patera, takes what is his, the championship belt.
Wizard's voice is so great, I think, because it reminds me a lot of a cartoon villain. For some reason, my mind is being drawn to Dr. Claw from Inspector Gadget. And I could just picture Wizard being the voice guy for that. I'll get you next time, Gadget. Next time. Or some bad guy in Scooby-Doo where I would have gotten it done, but if it wasn't for those meddling kids, McMahon. I always get a kick out of whenever anybody uses the word McMahon instead of McMahon when referring to Vince. Wizard, of course, does it there. I know the Honky Tonk Man would do that much later on. It was probably about the only thing I liked about him when he was on commentary during those weird 1997 Raws where he was searching for a new protege or whatever. Patera then says his piece, and what we got is that Patterson will be the referee. Pat Patterson will be the referee the next time Patera and Backlund face off at Madison Square Garden. And Patera makes the same accusations of Backlund that he was cheating to try and save his own belt. And then we have a Patterson promo to follow this, which he had just turned babyface in, I think it was December of 79, so very recent was that turn, and it was a very simple turn that involved the Grand Wizard, as the Grand Wizard was the manager of Pat Patterson, as all heels had to have a manager in the WWF of that time. And Wizard, what he did was he was talking about this grand deal that he had made, and wasn't really telling anybody, and as it came out, it was he had sold the contract of the Intercontinental Champion Patterson to Lou Albano. And Captain Lou was a lot of things, and he was not anything that Pat Patterson wanted to be associated with. So he didn't want anything to do with that slob, and that was how he turned babyface. Very nice and simple, and it led to the match that I alluded to earlier with Patterson and Albano. They had some matches, and what happened there was Patterson beat Albano to a bloody pulp, and Albano runs away to the locker room and just gets counted out. And the Patterson promo is very interesting in that you think of Pat Patterson as kind of the bumbling guy who has trouble being coherent and speaking. Oh, I go banana, they go banana, Vince. It's stuff like that. But this is a very coherent promo for somebody who's speaking in his second language and who has this reputation of somebody who just kind of fumbles his way along. He sounds very much like a Ronnie Garvin promo. Of course, Ronnie Garvin also from the province of Quebec, which a lot of people forget because he's so associated with the Carolinas and East Tennessee that he actually is a Quebecer himself. So it's fun to see these guys in this era just kind of doing their week-to-week thing instead of just seeing just highlights of them. When we get to our match here, which is Ken Patera with the Grand Wizard taking on Fred Marzino. And Fred Marzino is a jobber with a history that may interest me for reasons of geography, as he is announced from Stoneham, Massachusetts, which right next to where I grew up, and Stoneham is where my best friend is from, and I'm wondering where Marzino lived in Stoneham. I'm just wondering, did he go to, he's perhaps Roman Catholic, did he go to St. Patrick's? St. Patrick's has been renovated since then, very nice church. Now, on Cage Match here, Fred Marzino had a record of 3 wins, 119 losses, and 9 draws. And an 0-43 record in 1980. And as I've kind of been mentioning in the previous episodes, Cage Match and some of these other sites could be a little incomplete as we go along. But I did find out from Cage Match the calculation that I did from the Cage Match results before I discovered the wrestling data, which I'll get into in a second. According to Cage Match, Marzino had 105 consecutive losses dating from the start of his career in the 70s, and it ended on July 6th, 1983. The streak is over. I don't know if Paulie was there to make faces and all that, and he defeated Bob Bradley. But you go to historyofwwe.com, and it says that they fought to a 20-minute draw. So what is it? I'm going to say that Marzino actually won the match because it's a better story, and breaking a 105 loss streak, losing streak, is kind of amazing. Now, wrestling data is a lot more complete with a lot more matches, over 300 for Marzino, and they have his record at 9 wins, 299 losses, and 24 draws. And it also says that he had a win in July of 83, which big month for him in July of 83. Back on Cage Match, they had his record in July of 83 as 2 wins, no losses, and 2 draws. So imagine that. The guy went unbeaten for an entire month. He got a win over Samoan number 4. And when I saw that, I was like, there's a fourth Samoan? They're multiplying like Wayne's brothers there. And when I clicked on the link for Samoan number 4, I had that moment of, oh, it was the Samoan Savage, a.k.a. the Tonga Kid, a.k.a. Tama from the Islanders. And he had started out, I guess, as Samoan number 4 and evolved into the Tonga Kid by the end of the year because he was making appearances on WWF television by the end of 1983 as the Tonga Kid. Very precocious, not yet 20 years old at that point. Now, of course, Marzino has a long way to go if he wants to be the greatest wrestler ever from Stoneham, Massachusetts, as he's definitely behind Chaotic Wrestling mainstay, the sure thing Mark Sherman, a former champion of the promotion as recently as 2014 when he lost the title to Donovan Dijak. And let this be my weekly reminder, maybe not make it a weekly thing, but support your local indie promotion. Get out there and go to the matches, and I think you'll find you'll have a good time. Now, Patera, if all you know is the post-jail Ken Patera, you're in for a real treat if you watch him from 1980, because there's a serious argument to be made that he was the best wrestler in the world for 1980. He was certainly one of the most entertaining, with a great strongman douche gimmick that he had going on here. And he was being showered in gold, not taking golden showers, but he was being showered in gold in late April, where he won the Intercontinental title off of Pat Patterson on April 21st, and then 4 days later won the NWA Missouri title. So holding a WWF title and a NWA title simultaneously was not something you would see very often, but the WWF was still in the National Wrestling Alliance, as they were from 1971 up to August of 1983. The swinging full Nelson that Patera had was a very cool move, a big part of the act there. It was in the opening, the signature opening of your Coliseum videotapes, where he would be swinging the poor jobber around to and fro, and it was a very feared finisher. He did in Billy White Wolf with the full Nelson. He did not swing him around, but he effectively put out Billy White Wolf back in the day. This was a run before 1980, more I think 77 or 78 that he did that. Now, you might be saying, who the hell is Billy White Wolf? Well, kind of funny. I only learned this myself a few weeks ago. Billy White Wolf, a wrestler in the 70s, later went on to be General Adnan. And it was one of those Paul Harvey, now you know the rest of the story moments. A guy who went on to actually main event a WWF pay-per-view. So, yeah, General Adnan, Sheikh Adnan LKC, if you will. A couple more notes about Ken Patera from his big 1980. He had several great matches with Bob Backlund, including a Texas Death Match later that year. I forget if it was at MSG or at the Spectrum, but it's out there somewhere. I forget which show it's on. Another thing that Patera did, and it would be alluded to later on, I'm not sure if you remember in the late 1980s, when Ken Patera would be in a match and Gorilla Monsoon would be on commentary, Monsoon would sometimes make allusions that maybe Ken Patera should retire. He also would say things like, Kenny Patera is the one who gave me a negative attitude and retired me. And that is actually 100% true, that Gorilla Monsoon wrestled his retirement match against Ken Patera at the Philadelphia Spectrum in the later part of 1980. And I watched this match earlier today, and I was shocked and chagrined to see that Gorilla Monsoon got beat in his retirement match on a pin where Patera did not hook the leg. Because all I could think is, well, you're never going to beat him like that, Jess. But yes, Gorilla lost, and he was a rare example of somebody who 99.999% abided by the stipulation. He did wrestle a time or two in WWC in Puerto Rico in around 1983 time frame, but when they had that Legends Battle Royal in 1987, he did not take part in that, even though he probably would have been one of the younger guys in that match. He never came back to active competition. He went into the broadcast booth around 1982 and never looked back, of course. Now, the pre-match bit here with Patera in the ring, you have the introductions. He's wearing the kind of track outfit or whatever you want to call it that he's wearing. And the disrobing of Patera is almost like an HBO special presentation. Like, I almost feel like you should have, like, the static thing and have, like, the, and then have, like, the whole intro and whatever. Because what you have is he takes off the top in fairly good time, but with the pants, he goes to start to pull down the pants, but then he stops, and what he does is he has Wizard, who I just explained is this small gay man who is wearing a turban. He makes him get down on one knee, and Wizard disrobes Patera's pants from one knee, and this is all taking a while. I mean, it feels like it's taking a minute and a half here, and you get Vince openly wondering on commentary, and he tries to put it as gently as possible.
You know, sometimes you have to wonder a little bit about the personal relationship of the Grand Wizard and Ken Patera.
What are you insinuating, Vince? Anyway, let's just get to the match here. Literally, the disrobing, I think, takes longer than the actual match, which is announced as 2 minutes and 7 seconds, but felt like it went by in about 50 seconds. And Marzino got zero, absolute zero offense in this match. One thing that Patera does that seemed a little different from other guys of the time period is his body slam was slightly different in that he would kind of throw the guy across the ring a little bit. So, kind of showing off the strength there. A lot of forearm and elbow smashes and whatnot. Gets him in the full Nelson, starts swinging him around, which is a really cool visual and makes for a great GIF file, which I'll try to put together a little bit after this episode is released. And he refuses to let go of the hold, and Dick Worley, the referee, starts counting for whatever reason, like he's going to disqualify him. And Wizard gets in the ring to kind of distract him so he can work over Marzino a little bit more. Marzino doesn't get beat up too badly here, but they still bring out the stretcher for him. So I thought, kind of a weak stretcher job. Get stretchered out for losing in a 2-minute match seems a little weak, but does put over Patera as a super strong man here. I'm rather taken by Grand Wizard's pants, which we get a better look at as he's leaving the ring after the bout, where on one pant leg, it's red in the front and white on the back, and on the other pant leg, it is reversed. And, you know, 1980 was a completely different fashion era, and we're talking about a zany wrestling manager, so I don't know what I could really say there. But Ken Patera, if you ever see anything Ken Patera related from 1980, I recommend you check it out, because there's definitely, like I said, the argument to be made that he was the best wrestler in the world for the year 1980. And oh yeah, I gotta throw in one more observation about the stretcher spot here. Of course, he's being stretchered out because he would have a neck injury from the full Nelson. The stretcher is really just two bamboo sticks with a little, like, hammock thing in the middle. So they're carrying him out like that, and if he has this neck injury, there's no braces to, like, keep his neck from moving or anything like that. Just get him the hell out of there and get him to the back. That's how they did things back then. It was so much more casual.
Hey, hey.
Next up, we have Intercontinental Champion Pat Patterson taking on Jose Estrada in what looks to be an extended match here. And a bit about Patterson. I read his book last year, which is called Accepted, and I found it to be a very interesting read from my perspective. I did a six-part review on my blog, section309.com, kind of taking highlights from that book and talking about the various aspects. I think I devoted one entire part of it to just the Ray Stevens stories chapter, because that was a lot of fun. Some of the stories, Ray Stevens on the road with Pat Patterson, two very different men, shall we say. And I was particularly pleased when Patterson's co-author reached out to me in the comments to say thank you for the kind words I had for that book. The only thing I wish that there was in Patterson's book is I wish he went into a little bit more detail about his wrestling days, at least in the WWF from 1979 to 1981, because he did say that his feud with Sergeant Slaughter in 1981, which I'm sure I definitely have to cover in a future episode, was the best thing that he ever did in ring, but he didn't really elaborate too much on it beyond, you know, a few cute comments about the Cobra Clutch challenge angle, that stuff like Slaughter never paid him for breaking the hold. He never really talked about his feud with Patera, but he did mention that he was very proud of the fact that when they brought him in 1979, he had his program with Bob Backlund at Madison Square Garden. And the general rule of it was, a program would go three matches. You would have screwy finish, and then other kind of screwy finish, and then you would have Bob prevailing cleanly at the end. If it was one or two matches, it would generally be considered something of a failure, because it was a three-round thing that they would do. Patterson was a real exception, because he got four matches with Backlund at Madison Square Garden, and they had the usual two screwy matches to start out. And on the third one, what they did, and unfortunately, it didn't appear to make tape for whatever reason. I forget the exactly what happened there. But the finish that they did was a double knockout finish, which was very rare for that time period. I know it was done later on in other matches, and maybe it was Triple H and Shawn Michaels much, much later on. I think that might have been Patterson's influence in the booking at that time. And then they did a cage match for the fourth match, and Backlund escaped the cage first. So Patterson was actually never pinned cleanly and decisively by Backlund, which he pointed out in the book there. Pat's never going to win any look or body awards. He's never going to be a Jesse the Body Award winner. You know, his physique, not exactly the more modern look that you would see. But for the time period that he was wrestling and out in San Francisco for Roy Shire's promotion, and I have to digress for a second. One of the interesting things of the book is the fact that Patterson talks about being, well, not openly gay, but it was kind of an open secret, and how, of course, the title of the book is Accepted. And it is interesting that in a weird circus-like atmosphere like wrestling, he generally did not run into too many problems and not too many bigots along the way who are anti-gay. From what I gathered, the most anti-gay person that he ran into during that whole time, ironically, was Roy Shire, the guy that he worked for the most. But in any event, Patterson's working style is more that of a play to the last row kind of guy. In his team with Ray Stevens as the Blonde Bombers, he was more the mat based, because Stevens is going to fly around, take the crazy bumps, and Patterson was much more conventional. His selling, he would play, as I said, he would play to the last row, so almost like theatrical, which goes back to he wanted to be in theater growing up in Montreal before he discovered the wacky world of pro wrestling. And here, Patterson, he gets jumped at the opening bell here by Estrada, who actually leaps through the air at him as he's trying to take his jacket off, Patterson is. And it just reminds me, always remove your jacket before the guy gets a chance to jump you. How many times do you see on these Saturday morning shows a guy get jumped while he's trying to remove his jacket? I mean, it does put your arms in kind of a prone position there. But the cool thing about that start to the match there is that we get to see Pat fire up, and that was also one of his strengths as a worker, is his babyface comeback, which most of his career was as a heel, but when he became a babyface just before this time period we're talking about here, the way he would fire up and make his comeback, which is so critical for any babyface, it was just awesome stuff. And it certainly doesn't hurt that he's got a great working punch, which is an art that may or may not be lost these days. I feel like you don't see the great working punch like you do with Patterson and Jerry Lawler, Terry Funk, just the way those guys would deliver it, I really enjoyed. He fires Estrada to the outside, and they do that trope, one of the great tropes, where Estrada is holding on to the ropes on the apron, and Patterson grabs the ropes and kind of slingshots him back in. Ted DiBiase would do that a lot as well. And, of course, the whole idea is, well, why does the guy not just let go of the ropes? Why does he continue hanging on the ropes? Well, because the apron, this is me perhaps trying to explain the kayfabe nature of it, the apron is pretty narrow, and if he lets go, he might fall backwards off the apron, and then ends up doing a Cactus Jack Nestie bump. So it's better that he hold on to the rope, come in, land on his back in the ring, rather than land on the cement floor going backwards. At least that's just the way I see it, anyway. Patterson starts working on the left leg and kind of slides Estrada and kind of runs the leg into the ring post Estrada on his back in the ring. Vince says that Patterson has always believed in an eye for an eye, which, of course, would come up again in the Slaughter series in 1981. He gets Estrada in a toe hold, and Estrada grabs the ropes, but Patterson refuses to break it. And the referee doesn't really do anything to break the hold, so Patterson just keeps it on and pulls him away from the ropes. And it's a reminder, he's acting still very much like a heel, some heelish tactics by Patterson here. I mean, he was a heel only 6 weeks before this, 2 months before this, so it's like what I said a few episodes ago, it doesn't make sense for a guy who was a heel and becomes a babyface to immediately lose all of the tendencies that he had before. It should be a gradual transition as you go in. You shouldn't have the trust and friendship of everybody in the quote-unquote babyface locker room the second you make that turn. It should be a gradual thing. That's one of those subtle things that gets missed in wrestling all the time. Vince on commentary here, of course, we got Bruno and Larry kind of looming, like casting a huge shadow over everything to come here, and says that they've been getting a lot of positive letters and feedback for Larry Zbysko leading up to this match, and that this appears to be an even matchup, which, putting Larry and Bruno on par here is something that would be, considering the stature that Bruno had in 1980 after 17 years as head of this promotion, it's kind of interesting that you would say that. Patterson then ties Estrada in the ropes and then eventually slingshots him over the ropes, but instead of, usually when you see a slingshot, you see the slingshot into the corner, so you can hit the buckle. Estrada gets slingshotted into the ropes, and he just kind of flies over. And eventually they come back in. Patterson, just kind of a quick sequence there, and then a sunset flip wins it for him. And this was very exciting. It was about 7 minutes, 7.5 minutes, and it was kind of fun to see Patterson out there kind of unleashing the full arsenal there. And of course he would eventually lose the Intercontinental title to Ken Patera in April, as I mentioned earlier, and they would start that feud as a result of Patterson being the special referee at the next Madison Square Garden show in the Bob versus Patera match, and you can probably figure out what happened in that case. Kind of a bizarre interlude right now, as we have Vince at ringside again plugging the February show at Madison Square Garden, which included a Hulk Hogan versus Tito Santana match. Very interesting, two of the mainstay babyfaces of later in the 1980s. It's a strange interlude here because we have a second Patterson promo for the exact same thing. I don't know what was going on here, but he just vows to be an impartial arbiter in the Backlund-Patera match, and that he's not going to be knocked down like that other referee was, and that there will be a winner. So, that's that. And Bob Backlund comes in with his usual hockey player interview, which, you know, he's from Minnesota, so I can understand why that was kind of his promo style. He kind of talked like this. Vince, got to give 110% every time out there. You got to take it one match at a time, and you got to put the puck in the net. Oh, wait, that's the actual hockey player interview there at the end. And Bob was always a little awkward, but it was a different time in wrestling in 1980 and during his whole era. It was a time when the kind of authenticity was much more appreciated, at least in terms of a down-to-earth authenticity. It wasn't like an outsized character or anything like that. And he and Vince have like just a really strange and awkward exchange there where they're just kind of stumbling over each other, where Vince brings up how Patera says that Backlund threw himself into the ref to get the match thrown out or whatever. And but that's not true. He's glad that Patterson will be the referee there. And he's also glad that as a wrestler himself, that he will call the match as a wrestler would. So that adds kind of one psychological element to that match, in that Patterson might be more willing to let things go if somebody wanted to bend the rules. Of course, I don't think that would necessarily be to Bob's benefit, since he was not really much of a brawler or a rule breaker anyway.
I was trained by Bruno Sammartino, and he taught me almost everything I know. And it was very hard for me not to talk to Bruno, but I couldn't get myself to talk to the man, and I'm going to tell everybody why. And I want to make this clear to everybody. I do not hate Bruno. I do not disrespect Bruno. But I have to become Larry Zbysko to survive in my chosen field, in my career. For years now, I've been walking down the street and I've been recognized as, hey, you're the one that Bruno trained, aren't you? And I've been walking down the street for years and people have been coming up to me and say, hey, there's Bruno's protege. And I've been getting this all over the world, not just where I live. I've even been getting it from some members of my family that introduced me. This is my nephew, the wrestler. Bruno trained him.
And that is from the January 12th episode of Championship Wrestling, a Larry Zbysko promo that led to the initial challenge to Bruno Sammartino. And you can see he kind of goes into some, you know, deep places where he talks about being depressed, as being labeled as Bruno's protege, to the point where it's almost funny at the end, where he's saying that he's being introduced by members of his own family as Bruno's protege, the wrestler. Now, the challenge here did not exactly come out of nowhere, as on previous episodes, Zbysko had been kind of ignoring Sammartino. Sammartino would come down to do the interview at ringside after a match or whatnot, and Zbysko really wouldn't want to face him and talk to him because of this mental issue that he was having of feeling like he was in Bruno's shadow at all times. And this is him just kind of letting out his emotions. A very cathartic 5-minute promo here, and something that seems a little bit more unusual. It's very measured in tone. It's not yelling or screaming or anything. And now Bruno, for his part, he's really taken aback by this, because he considers Larry not like a son. Bruno, through this, was very careful to say that Larry was not like a son. He would refer to him as a brother. So there's kind of a difference there, in that if you have like a father-son thing, you kind of have one above the other, because, you know, the father and the son, you're older, whatever. With brothers, you can kind of treat it as equals. So I think it was important for him to use that terminology. And Vince goes to Bruno at kind of the closing remarks of the show, the final thought, if you will. And Bruno is just, as I said, very nonplussed and isn't quite sure how to react to Larry Zbyszko's challenge to what he said would be a scientific match. And he said two times in the promo, Larry says, "I don't hate Bruno. I don't hate Bruno." And wanted to make that clear. But this is what Bruno had to say in response at the end of the January 12th episode.
Well, Vince, it's very difficult for me to respond, because I'm still in a state of shock. I feel kind of bad, sad about the whole thing. All I know in my heart is I have a brother and three sons. I love Larry as much as I love my own sons and my brother. And all I've ever tried to do with Larry was to help him the best possible way I could. I never realized that he felt that way. Vince, honestly,
what about the challenge, Bruno? He challenged you. What about a match? He challenged you to a match.
I don't want to believe that I heard that. I don't want to believe it, Vince, and I can't even comment on it. I couldn't even talk about it.
So Bruno right now just kind of refusing to believe that Larry really feels that way, and he wants to discuss it with him and doesn't want to throw himself into a match with Larry Zbyszko. So a neat little cliffhanger as they go into next week. Now, you knew that this was kind of a big deal, because what they were doing with Larry matches at this point in time in January of 1980 is they were airing it, of course, on Championship Wrestling, but they were airing the identical match on All-Star Wrestling as well. And that was something that was common, that if you really wanted to play it up, you were going to throw the exact same thing on both shows. And you would see that later on, where the same thing would be on Superstars and Challenge, particularly Piper's Pit with Hogan and Andre, the weekend that it aired on Superstars, as covered in episode 4 of Greetings from Allentown. It also aired on Wrestling Challenge the next day, which would have been February 8th, 1987. So we go to next week, and it's January 19th. It's the last hour of tapings from January 1, 1980, which, so it's so cool that the actual taping took place on New Year's Day 1980. And what a way to kick off the decade of the 1980s with this one. And we don't have a Larry appearance on January 19th show, but Vince is pressing the point with Bruno, saying that he's gotten a week to process the challenge from Larry Zbyszko, and they kind of do the same thing with the Jerry Springer final thought with Bruno and how he feels about the Zbyszko challenge.
Me now, ladies and gentlemen, Bruno Sammartino. And Bruno, I know you're in a very tough position. Wrestler extraordinaire, commentator, friend of so many fans, so many wrestlers, but and I know it's tough for you to react to what has happened as of late with Larry Zbyszko, but we have to put you on this spot. I think the fans certainly are deserving of an explanation of how you feel, again, about the challenge that was issued.
I got to interrupt here for a second, because that is one hell of a filibuster by Vince there. Maybe he missed his calling and should have been a United States Senator, right? probably shouldn't have said that, because that might actually give him some ideas, and God knows we have enough McMahons in U.S. politics right now. It took him, like, literally, he could have said, Bruno, will you accept the challenge? You've had a week to think about it. Instead, he does the Vince McMahon thing where you ask him what time it is and he tells you how a watch works and is built and is operated. It's so circuitous how he gets around to it. Anyway, let's throw it back to Bruno.
By Larry Zbyszko, and will you accept his challenge? Will you face Larry Zbyszko?
Well, first of all, Vince, let me tell you this, okay? You know, I've had my neck broken, I've had my arm broken, I've had serious, serious injuries, but none of those injuries have hurt me as hurt as I feel right now. And I feel equally bad that Larry feels hurt, which I never knew before. I never knew that he had these feelings that he has expressed. I can't tell you about how terrible I feel about this whole thing, because I love the guy like a brother. I've always tried my darnest to never be holding back anything and everything that I could show him that would be beneficial to him in his career. He's been the Rookie of the Year the very first year as a pro. He's respected by all wrestlers. The fans all love him. He's been all over the world, and his promoters are always requesting to have his services again because he's such a great wrestler. I thought Larry had the world by the hand, and I thought he was the happiest guy in the world. I have to find this out. I feel crushed. I feel hurt. I feel bad for him because he feels so sad. But now you ask me, will I accept the challenge? Vince, I think you know me a long time, and I like to hope, I believe, all the fans that know me for a long time know that I've never refused a challenge from anyone. But Larry Zbyszko, Vince, it's like somebody asking me, Bruno, how about signing a match with your younger brother and go out there and try to hurt him, try to beat him, try to make him suffer? How in the world could anyone do that? I hope the fans know me.
No, I
couldn't do it. It just wouldn't be in my heart. There's no way.
Well, let me say this, that there are, and I'm not one of them, I'm just stating in effect what some fans are going to say. Some fans are going to say, Bruno, and I think you've got to face this question. They're going to say, Bruno, come on, are you afraid of Larry Zbyszko? Is there a little inkling of cowardice in Bruno Sammartino? I think you're going to have to answer that question.
I hope not. I hope people won't think that way, and I hope they'll be sympathetic to my feelings in this situation. I have to repeat, those who have known me for all the years I've been around, I've faced every opponent in the world that ever came my way. But now you're asking me to meet Larry Zbyszko. I repeat, I love this man like I love my own brother, my younger brother. How could I have it in my heart? Nah, if they all feel that way, I'm sorry, but there's no way. I just don't know. It just isn't in me to be able to go in the ring with Larry Zbyszko. I can't even imagine it.
How do you feel Larry Zbyszko will react to this this negative vote, in effect, on your part?
I really don't know. Maybe perhaps he won't be happy. I don't know, because I don't know how to even answer that question. I just hope that he will be sympathetic enough to understand my feelings. I can understand his feeling in wanting me in there. I don't know. I'm so confused and hurt. I can't tell you.
Thanks again. Bruno Sammartino, ladies and gentlemen, with his views. We shall return with the fabulous Hulk Hogan in the following match.
Okay, I'll let that part go about the fabulous Hulk Hogan, because that's what he was going by at that point there. But Bruno, again, Bruno was not so much a yeller and a screamer. You know, he did not deliver crazy cocaine-fueled promos like you'd see later in the 80s from Hogan and this and that kind of stuff. He's being very calm and very rational. And, you know, he has 17 years of goodwill with the fans of the WWF. And he, time and again, would talk people into the buildings, selling out Madison Square Garden, the Spectrum, the Boston Garden. He's a god in all of those cities. And he's just calmly explaining that he cannot fight his brother. And this is a story that, again, was told time and again. You had even something as kind of weird as the Undertaker-Kane thing, which is a very beloved angle by people of my generation who were teenagers or younger or even a little bit older growing up in that 1997-98 time period. What they did then, if you recall, was that the Undertaker didn't want to fight his brother. And so it is here, because Bruno considers Larry like a brother. And as I said, it's very important that he says brother instead of son, because it makes it a lot less pejorative. It doesn't relegate Larry to a sort of lower status there. And he's doing this in such a way that you feel for Bruno. He doesn't understand why Larry feels this way. You know, he's a sensitive guy. He's trying to understand why, but he can't go into the ring and hurt Larry. And that actually goes into what happens in the match here, where we'll cover it coming up in what Bruno does during the actual match with Zbyszko, because he doesn't want to hurt Larry because he considers him like a brother. He doesn't want to, yes, brothers fight and all that, but he doesn't want to take him down and make him submit or pin him or anything like that. So Bruno is in kind of a weird place right now on the 19th of January. We go to the next show on January 26th, and now we're on the taping, the same taping as this episode aired on, and Zbyszko has a match, and he does the post-match interview at ringside. But before I get to the interview from after the match with John Buford, I want to comment on the match itself there, which is kind of interesting because when you watch it from a modern perspective, you're kind of looking for signs that Larry is going to be a little bit heelish or if he's going to try to break the rules. And he did nothing in the match that would indicate that he was going to be turning heel. So it was very well hidden. Yes, he did fire up at one point and all that, but it's not as if he, you know, started choking Buford when he didn't give a clean break at one point in the corner. So Larry, he's wearing the same trunks as he'd be wearing for the Bruno match later on in the taping. So after the match, he wins with the vertical suplex, and he signals to Vince, kind of over towards, I guess, where they kept the broadcast area there in the old agricultural hall at Allentown, signals for him and Bruno to come on down because Larry has something to say. And it's at this point here where you kind of feel things starting to turn, in that Larry starts acting like a child, kind of saying it's either going to be my way or the highway.
I came out here a couple weeks ago and I poured my guts out to the fans. I made a statement of my own search, my own quest for self-recognition in my business. I made a challenge and a demand of Bruno, and I heard Bruno's reply. Bruno refused to give me the opportunity I asked for. And I hope you people enjoyed my match today, because as far as I'm concerned, if I can't have a chance to prove myself as me, this is the last match Larry Zbyszko is going to wrestle. I can't exist. I am not going to exist in the business if I have to remain a shadow and a specter. I demanded something out of Bruno, and he didn't feel he should do it. I can't make Bruno do it. I can't make anybody do anything, but I can do for me. And I have to know right now, I'm not going to wrestle again. I want Bruno to come out here, and I want Bruno to say if he wants to wrestle me to my face, or if he doesn't, whatever he wants.
Now, one thing I should add here is during the match with Buford, Vince once again pressed Bruno for an answer on this, if he would wrestle Zbyszko. And this is the third straight week of badgering that Bruno was taken from Vince, and he just flat out says that he's not going to do it. But now he has to go down to ringside, and Larry has kind of made his childish demand of sorts. I mean, you have to call it childish because he's going to take his ball and go home. Well, that's a phrase that would come up in wrestling some 22 years later. But in any event, Bruno is really saddened by the fact that this has happened, and he doesn't want to be responsible for ending a career that he helped get off the ground.
It's true that last week or 2 weeks, whatever it's been, I said that I would never wrestle Larry Zbyszko, and I did mean it. However, I don't want it to be said that Larry's career may be ruined because of my refusal to go in the ring with him, number one. Number two, we've received so much mail from the fans saying that they want me to wrestle Zbyszko. And all the years I've been wrestling, the fans have known me never to run away from any opponent. And I surely will not run away from this particular bout, which I really don't have my heart into it. However, there has to be a compromise here. I will go into the ring with Larry under these conditions. I will go in there to give him the opportunity to prove to the fans that he's a better man than I, if that's what he wants. Okay. For myself, I am not interested to go into that ring and defeat Larry Zbyszko. So what I will do is this. I will accommodate the fans. If they do want me to go in there, I will. I will accommodate.
You can hear the response here.
I will please Larry Zbyszko into proving what's been haunting him all this time, which I had no knowledge of. However, I will say this. If Larry wants to try and beat me, fine. I will do everything in my power to stop him from beating me. As far as him trying to out-wrestle me, he'll have to be better because I will do everything in my power to keep my reputation at stake. But what I will not do is I'm not going to go in that ring and try to defeat Larry Zbyszko because I could not find in my heart to apply a hold on him and say, quit or I'll break your arm, because I still regard Larry Zbyszko. I have the same love for him as I have for one of my brothers. And I do not find it in my heart to go near and hurt Larry or try to defeat him. However, I will say this, that since Larry wanted this badly, he's going to have to show the fans and everybody and himself that he is the better man, because I will give nothing in there.
Wow. I feel like I'm an English professor here breaking down some sort of Shakespearean tragedy here, but that's a tremendous promo from Bruno, and part of it is the subtle emotions that he's conveying to the audience and how just completely conflicted he is about doing this. Now, this is why it's important to kind of know the build of the Bruno and Larry match. If you know the generalities of the story, and if you've watched Best of the WWF Volume 1, and you see this match in a vacuum, you see it as protege turns on the mentor, da-da-da, but there's just so much more put into this, and there's so much more emotion behind it, helped by this build, because not only of Larry's promos, because he's obviously, this couldn't have been done without him, but because of Bruno and just his massive appeal to the audience and all the goodwill capital, I guess, kind of an interesting term since his Capital Wrestling Corporation, that he had built up with that audience. I mean, you turn on Bruno, I mean, In a vacuum, though, it's a lot different watching this than having seen this stuff that all came before. And it's yet another reason why I love having all this footage on YouTube to go see, to really dive in and dig into the whole history of whatever you want to know about the wrestling business. So without any further ado, they have a little match on this show, February 2nd, 1980. It's so funny how we don't talk anymore. It's so funny why we don't talk anymore. By the end of this week. Now, I've done a lot of talking here to build up to this historic match. And you're probably wondering, in terms of the angle itself, whose idea was it to pull the trigger with this? Well, it was not Vince McMahon Sr., who, by all accounts that I've researched and read about, was against the idea, feeling that it wouldn't draw money. But what happened was Bruno stepped in and spoke up for the idea. So it was really Bruno that kind of pushed that across the finish line. And Larry Zbyszko has said that in various shoot interviews. But with Larry in shoot interviews, I have to keep the BS filter clean at all times, because there's a lot of it from him in some of those. But from discerning all different accounts of what happened and what went into this, I do believe that it was Bruno's idea to put this together to kind of put Larry over, not necessarily lose to Larry Zbysko on the way out, but this was a way of making him before Bruno was, he was obviously planning to step away from the business. He had tried to retire in the past and was just unable to for whatever reason. And of course, his retirement in 1981 would not last very long because he would be back in the announce booth in 1984, and then he would be back in the ring in 1985, all kind of in support of his actual birth son, David, in that case. Another thing about this match is the concept of the scientific match. And I haven't really done a lot of comedy or as my wife says that I do, alleged comedy. And the term scientific match has always tickled me for a very long time. And the joke in college was whenever it would be a scientific match, you know it's not truly scientific until you see the Bunsen burner in the Erwin-Meyer flask. Is it Erlenmeyer flask or Erwin-Meyer flask? I don't know. I always got C's in science. In I was more of a brawler than a scientist in high school. So here we are with Bruno and Larry, and we have Dick Worley, of course, as the referee, which he bothers me for a different reason, and it's because he wears a different outfit than the other referees on this show. And it's like, what makes you so special, Dick Worley? Who do you think you are? Danny Davis? Danny Davis down the line would wear like khaki pants for the Boston Garden House show while all the other refs were dressed the way referees were supposed to be dressed. So the biggest match that we've done on this show, and of course it is the logo of the show, which funny story about the logo for Greetings from Allentown. It was something that I threw together in about 21 minutes while trying to get the show on iTunes around episode 1 or episode 2, somewhere in that time. It was definitely after the first episode was released because I hadn't even established the full SoundCloud account yet. At that time, I had originally put it up on the blog for download, where it had to be under, I think, 60 megs or something like that. And I was trying to figure out something that would capture the essence of something that was named Greetings from Allentown. And my mind kind of went to, okay, in the time period 1978 to 1984, what was the most famous thing that happened in the arena in Allentown? And It was this match, and it's not even close. And it also helped that there were a number of clean pictures that worked in, both Bruno and Larry just facing off with the ring. It's a really nice background. And the cursive writing there, I don't know why I chose that. Maybe it just reminded me of the quote-unquote Caddyshack font that they use for the credits at the beginning of Caddyshack for all the names, you know, Ted Knight and Chevy Chase and all that. So that's kind of what got in. Anyway, I've spent enough time with this build-up, so let's get to the match, okay? Now, this is extremely rare for Bruno to be on TV. As a matter of fact, I can't find any record of Bruno actually wrestling in a match on the weekly TV. I feel like it must have happened at some point in his heyday, but at least in the records that I'm looking at Cage Match, I can't find anything. I'm not going to dig too deep here because obviously I've done enough stalling here. So just get right to the match. They're very tentative going in. They're both a little unsure. And when they lock up, Bruno keeps breaking clean. Larry tries to go for the leg, either a single leg takedown or whatever, and Bruno evades that. Bruno executes a standing switch, and then Larry can't execute the standing switch, and before he even gets a real chance to, the hold is released by Bruno. And remember, this is what Bruno said he was going to do. He wasn't going to try to win the match, pin Larry, or make him submit. Vince here kind of, you know, in this ultra serious match here, kind of makes me laugh given what we know about Vincent Kennedy McMahon now that probably was not the case in 1980. Quote, scientific wrestling skill, that's the name of the game. Like, wow, that's very odd to hear Vince say something like that. Larry with a hip toss and goes down for a quick two, and then a shoulder block, he follows with that. Then you get a drop toe hold by Bruno. And one thing I'm really taken by early in this match is just how quick Larry Zbyszko is. The Zbyszko that we all know is probably the one later in the 80s, either in the NWA or the AWA, who, like I've joked about many times now, was a staller, not exactly the most dynamic in-ring guy, but he is quick as a cat at this point when he's 28 years old. Slam by Larry, gets another two count, but then Bruno responds with a slam of his own, and Larry is starting to get a little upset there. You can tell he kind of hits the mat there. The two guys are back tentative again. They do a nice pose for the logo of this show, and then you get a wrist or hammer lock by Bruno, who releases the hold again. So we're back to square one here, and Larry gets an abdominal stretch, and Bruno ends up powering out of it with a hip lock. So he's using his size advantage there. Again, I have my kayfabe hat firmly in place. The chin strap is buckled for this match. Another slam by Larry, and he gets his third two count of the match. And then he scores with a single leg takedown into a half crab. And it was kind of interesting here in that Bruno could have grabbed the rope there, and he didn't. Instead, he did a rollover to counter instead of doing that, and gets out of the hold that way. So once again, frustration building slightly for Larry. Wrist lock by Bruno, but then he releases it again. And it kind of seemed like it was for no reason. Vince said he didn't want his strength tested or whatever. I thought that was a strange remark, given that Bruno is this, you know, he's basically a strong man from Italy. I mean, that's kind of who he is. And it's really because that's what he said he was going to do. He wasn't going to make Larry submit to a wrist lock or whatever. Then we get a crisscross, which more famously you'd see the crisscross in the Hogan Ultimate Warrior. They seem to like that spot a lot. But Bruno reverses Larry's hip toss attempt into one of his own. Now the anger level rising. I think you can raise the Larry Z threat level from yellow to orange at this point. Of course, that's now kind of a dated reference that I'm making there. Larry runs the ropes here, and he ends up in a bear hug. And that bear hug, one of Bruno's finishing maneuvers of the time, and after a beat of about 5 seconds or so, Bruno just releases the hold. And even I, in kayfabe, have to say that that kind of looks bad by Bruno. He is a man of his word, and that meant a hell of a lot in 1980 to the fans. But when you look at it with a critical eye, you would say, Bruno, you said you weren't going to pin him or make him submit. Why are you putting him in the bear hug, which is one of your big moves? Probably should not have used the move. Or if you are going to use the move, maybe just try to win the match then and there. Go back on your word this one time instead of releasing the hold after 5 seconds, because it did kind of make Larry look like a chump there. And Larry's threat level is rising again. And he's more pissed off now. And now here comes the big spot here. Larry gets a hammer lock, and Bruno is looking for the escape there. And he goes to the near side of the ring from the camera perspective. And Larry, they end up slipping, and Larry ends up falling to the outside. So, oops, there. That Bruno did not mean to do that. And he confers with the referee. I'll take off my kayfabe hat and helmet right now. He's handed something by the referee. Wonder what that might be. But Bruno feels bad here. Kayfabe hat back on. And he opens the rope for Larry to come back in. And Larry was kind of pacing on the outside trying to collect his thoughts. But now you can raise threat level to red, because Larry, as he's getting into the ring, knees Bruno in the gut and then starts just working him over, ends up throwing him into the corner turnbuckle. Bruno collapses center of the ring, and Larry heads to the outside. And in a fun bit of irony here, given Bruno's disdain for the steroid culture that would envelop the WWF in the years to come, Larry steals the chair of Dr. George Zaharian, the doctor behind much of that stuff that was going on, who would be convicted in the early 90s of such shenanigans and whatnot. So he grabs the wooden chair, and the referee, Dick Worley, tries to get in the way, and Worley gets tossed for his trouble. Not the best ref toss in the world. He just kind of throws him into the ropes, and Worley kind of gets stuck there for a second and looks like a fish out of water or whatever. So Worley's out of the picture now. And Larry has got the chair, and he's measuring Bruno. And Larry whacks Bruno in the head with the wooden chair, and he really measures him good. It's not a full swing of the chair like you would see from... He kind of does it in a three-quarters kind of way that makes it look like he's not swinging it as hard as he can. The way I take it is that he's trying to hit Bruno in a precise spot. He's not going for bat speed here. He's there to make sure he's making contact. I don't know if he choked up on the chair or something to make sure that he hit Bruno just right, but he nails him with the chair, and Bruno goes down like a ton of bricks. And then he does it again two more times, and it's the crowd here. When Larry knees Bruno in the gut coming back into the ring, you can sense kind of a change in the air, like kind of a hush falls over the crowd a bit. And then the crowd starts screaming. It's not really, really loud screaming, because the crowd is still trying to process what's going on here. This isn't, you know, like a Memphis beat down on the floor or whatever. They're not crazy, but it does build as it goes along. And Bruno is left face down, bleeding all over the mat. They have to spend some time later trying to clear the blood off the mat there. And this was a incredibly effective use of the blood, because to see Bruno Sammartino, the legend of legends, the living legend, just laid out, and they bring out the stretcher for him, and they take Bruno out on a stretcher. This is how you make a guy. It's just awesome stuff. And there's often I like to critique, oh, well, you could have done this. You could have. There's nothing else they could have done. It was absolutely perfect the way this was executed, from soup to nuts, from the original Larry ignoring Bruno and his promos, and then Bruno's kind of unsure promos where he doesn't want to fight a guy that he considers a brother. The way this was all put together was just perfect. And much like the Mega Powers breakup in 1989, which of course started in 1988, I wouldn't change anything about this. It's just perfect wrestling from start to finish. And it made Larry Zbyszko what he would become. Now, Larry would not... It always seems in retrospect, well, why didn't he get the world title out of this? And there was probably some thought given to that, but New York, of course, was a babyface territory. They would have your Bruno or your Pedro Morales or your Bob Backlund at that time running on top. And the heel champions were mere transition champions, with the exception of Graham, who you could actually argue that his reign of 10 months was an actual transitional reign, because he knew he was going to be losing it at the point that he got it, 10 months from the point that he won the title from Bruno. So what happened here, of course, is they had matches in the territory to build up, and the big blow-off would be at Shea Stadium in August of 1980. That card is on YouTube, and it's a very odd card in that the announcers are Michael Cole and Mick Foley. I'm not entirely clear on what happened to the original footage of it, or if there was no commentary at the beginning. I would have sworn that Vince did original commentary, but they re-recorded it with Michael Cole, who I know takes a lot of crap, but he's actually not that bad on that show. And Foley, at least, was, you know, a kid at the time and can kind of bring that perspective. I know he gets some criticism these days in some circles, but it's a perfectly fine card to watch. And the blow-off in the cage, Bruno leaves Larry Lehen and escapes the cage before, I think it's 36,000 at Shea Stadium, so one hell of a gate for the WWF then. Now, Larry, a year from this time, 1981, he's out of the WWF, and it just seems completely bizarre why a guy who was so hot of a heel that people were turning over his car and fans were looking to attack him, why was he gone? Well, it always comes back to the almighty dollar, and Larry felt that his payoff for the Shea Stadium show was not quite up to snuff. But there was also other issues as well, since he went down to the Intercontinental level when Pedro won the title at the very end of the year, but he wasn't going to be given that title either. So what he decided was, rather than to stick around and be jobbing to Tony Atlas, who we're going to be seeing coming up next here, that he would just leave and kind of protect the reputation that he had built up in the WWF at that time. And he goes elsewhere, and it's just never quite the same. Of course, he was the AWA champion, but that was in 1989, when that title was not of the same prestige that it was, let's say, earlier in the 1980s. And I don't know, Larry never came back to the WWF to wrestle after that time. And of course, he was always linked with Bruno. And Bruno, when he came back in 1984, there was always the rumor that Larry was going to come in as well and perhaps feud with David Sammartino. But that just never ended up happening. And Larry wrestled elsewhere for the rest of his career. And it was just one of those things where he had his big moment here, and he lived off it for the rest of his career, which was about a decade and a half. He was still in WCW in the mid-1990s. I don't think I'm going to count his little feud with Scott Hall around that 97-98 time period. Although Larry Z does deserve credit for his role in the New World Order angle of 96, 97, and 98. He was one of the announcers who would actually kind of, quote, stand up to them. And he had the match with Bischoff at Starrcade 97 that, of course, was a bit of a mess. But that's not entirely his fault. It's just the way it's just the way that WCW was. But Larry Zbyszko, you're always left wondering if he could have been a world champion. I don't know if, based on what his working style ended up becoming, but the heat that he was able to generate from this one angle was just incredible, and it's really amazing stuff. And of course, we owe a lot of this to Bruno, and he truly is the living legend of professional wrestling.
How can you stop the rain from falling down?
How can you stop the sun from shining? What makes the world go round?
How can you mend this broken man? How can a
loser ever win.
Please help me mend.
Quick epilogue to this. On next week's Championship Wrestling, February 9th, 1980, Bruno gives an amazing promo, which I'm going to have to play here in its entirety, or, well, at least until Vince just interrupts Bruno in the middle of this heartfelt speech that he's giving in an empty arena interview. You have Vince interviewing Bruno, and what's really interesting is they're sitting on the exact style of chair that Bruno got whacked with three times by Larry. So you just have these two men, and they're surrounded by the exact weapon used to break Bruno's heart, as it were. It's, I kind of, for whatever reason, the promo made me think of the Bee Gees song, "How Can You Mend a Broken Heart?" I'm no Gibb brother, I'll say that. But Bruno, of course, you know, he's a godfather-like figure, and he has rightfully feels betrayed. But it's not a yelling and screaming, "I'm going to get you, Zbysko," or anything like that. It's very calm, and it builds, of course, like I said, up until Vince just interrupts him and said, "We'll see you next week." And I got to play that, because this is an all-time promo right here.
How do I feel? It's, how do you describe how I feel? You know, in my life, I came from Italy. I lived in the mountains. I've known poverty. I've seen friends, relatives, members of my family die during a war, an ugly war. Talk about heartaches. Talk about really being broken up, feeling like it was the end. I thought I'd experienced all the ugliness that can occur in one's life. I really thought that, yeah, that I had my bad share of hardness in life. What am I saying? I'm saying that I went to sleep last night after coming out of the hospital where, as you know, I had to have transfusions, so loss of blood. Talk about nightmares. I had a long nightmare because I, without sleeping a wink, I paced the floor, I sat, I laid in bed, and I kept saying to myself, this is a nightmare. I got to be sleeping and imagining, dreaming this thing. But no, it wasn't. it wasn't a nightmare. It's a reality that I can't bring myself up to believe in to this point. Speaking of heartaches and broken hearts that one often hears, what is a broken heart? One can imagine. I've had my heart broken through my lifetime, remembering those days as a child in the war and members of the family and all this stuff. But I know today my heart is broken like I never knew a heart could be broken. Here's a man that I loved as much as one could love a brother. I always felt of Larry as my younger brother. I loved him like my brother. He had frustrations that I didn't understand, but then I tried to understand. He felt that I was holding him back. I, of all the people on this earth, never want to hold Larry Zbysko back because I care too much for the man. And this hurt. You asked me if I'd want to even wrestle the man. I don't want no part of going to the ring with Larry Zbysko, but I give it a lot of thought. The amount of mail we received asking me that I should wrestle Larry Zbysko. I felt hurt, Vince, in different ways, because even the mail, I always loved my fans because they've been so good to me for so many years. I felt a little hurt that they I took it, they wanted me to wrestle Zbyszko, suggesting him perhaps, what, was I afraid of him? I've never feared any man. I always had confidence in myself in the ring. But I brought myself up to it, to wrestle Larry, to satisfy him, to have him achieve whatever he was out to achieve, and to satisfy the fans because they wanted to see it. Against my wish, against my feelings, I didn't want to do it. Here's the man, Larry Zbyszko, the man that I so cared about, so believed in, Vince, in my busy schedule as I traveled the world over. I'd come home every once in a while, sometimes not home for 3 weeks at a time without coming home seeing my family. I have a family that I love dearly. I have a mother and father that are so special and I love them so dearly. I have a sister that I love with my heart and soul and her family as well as my brother. And I saw so much in this talent, this great talent. I so believe that here is a man. Here's a man who is so gifted that could contribute so much to this game that I've loved so much. And I took time from deprived my whole family because I wanted to take time because I thought.
Bruno, thank you for your reflections.
All right, to be fair to Vince there, he did kind of cut him off when Bruno was, again, it was a slow build in just anger in Bruno that he's trying to express there, and he kind of cut him off before things could have gone a little bit out of control. But we still have one more match here. Yeah, they got to scrape up all the blood, because there's still one more match on the taping. I don't know how they ordered it, if the Bruno-Larry thing definitely didn't come last, because they were trying to scrape the blood off, and they show it, actually, on the broadcast when they come back from commercial. But we got Tony Atlas now, and he's taking on Johnny Rods, the unpredictable Johnny Rods. And I knew his nickname a long time ago because my next-door neighbor, my sophomore year at BU, purchased a wrestling poster. It was one of those to promote some sort of event. I don't remember what the event was, but the main part of the poster said, "The Unpredictable Johnny Rods." And back in those days, I didn't really know too much about this era. I didn't know Johnny Rods would, you know, was a trainer at that time in the late 90s, or that, you know, what Johnny Rods was in the WWF of the time period. He is actually kind of the heel SD Jones of sorts, where he loses a lot on television, but he's not a guy who it looks bad, where he will get zero offense like we saw with Fred Marzino earlier in the show. He was also kind of an enforcer of sorts, where guys who were new to the territory, you know, baby faces who had just come in, would be thrown in with a Johnny Rods to kind of test them a little bit, and then Rods would kind of be almost like the foreman of sorts to, and would report back like, okay, this guy has it or whatever. And I had mentioned earlier the match that Rods had on January 21st, 1980 at Madison Square Garden against Kevin Von Erich. And it's a really peculiar match where it's a lot of choppy sort of stuff, like almost like Rods was really kind of testing Kevin Von Erich there, because of course that was his Madison Square Garden debut. And of course you never see a Von Erich, or at least Kevin Von Erich, wrestling in the WWF full time. But that was kind of Rods' role there, was to, you know, almost sort of like a human proving ground for the new talent coming in. Atlas was very, very young at this point in time, still in his mid-20s, and still a little bit green in the ring. He wasn't too dynamic in this match. I was expecting a lot more power stuff from Atlas, given that that later would become much of his thing, where, you know, press slams and whatnot. Didn't have even one body slam in this match, but he was very new to the WWF at this point. He had just come in recently, so this might have been one of those things where Rods is kind of the test for Tony Atlas. He actually won the Pro Wrestling Illustrated Most Improved Wrestler of the Year for 1980. So Atlas did make some progress as he made his way through this year. His He had a match with Ken Patera at that Shea Stadium show that I mentioned earlier, where Bruno and Larry drew the gate. Sorry, Hulk Hogan, you and Andre did not draw the gate that night. It was Bruno and Larry. But Atlas did not, of course, win the Intercontinental title from Patera in that one. I believe DQ finish, something like that. As we start the match here, and Vince, this is at this time in 1980, and it would change shortly thereafter. Vince is still doing the voiceovers during the match. We're coming to the Mid-Hudson Civic Center that Howard Finkel would famously do later on. Vince is doing it by himself here because you just can't get enough Vince Kennedy McMahon. And I'm really struck by the fact there's a show at Montvale High School in Montvale, New Jersey. But Vince can't say Montvale normally. He says it like it's two words. Montvale. And like, no, I grew up in a town where Montvale Avenue is one of the main streets, so maybe it's just easier for me, but it's Montvale, Vince, Montvale. Rods gets in a lot of offense in this match, and it kind of goes into my theory that I espoused earlier. He even ties Atlas in the ropes. It's a lot of kicky sort of stuff. Rods is not exactly the most dynamic guy on offense. Vince notes that there's a hush over the crowd, so I suspect that this was, of course, taped right after the Bruno Larry match, because they were showing them scraping up the blood as Rods was in the ring there. Atlas's comeback consists of two backdrops, and as I said, I was very disappointed. I was hoping for like maybe a press slam or even a body slam in 1980. I mean, that would have been something. Gets a bell ringer on Rods, which makes me wonder, is this the first bell ringer of the 1980s that we see on WWF television? The bell ringer is just kind of a 80s sort of move. Put the guy's head between your legs and just jump straight up and down. Real staple of the whole decade there. Yeah, just a lot of offense from Johnny Rods here. Brief comeback at the end, and you get Atlas getting the win with a headbutt off the second rope. Rods was standing. It wasn't like, you know, Atlas turned into Dynamite Kid or anything. So Atlas, new-ish in the promotion and being tested by Johnny Rods, but coming out with a victory here on WWF Championship Wrestling in the shadow of the Bruno Larry match.
This is unquestionably a dark day in pro wrestling. A day that Bruno Sammartino and the fans of the World Wrestling Federation will remember for a long time.
Before I get to YouTube comment theater, I kind of want to give a special platform to the WWF champion of the time period, Bob Backlund, and what he felt about the Bruno Larry angle, which, of course, drew great money, but, of course, may have overshadowed Backlund a little bit, although Backlund's 1980 was still really, really strong with a lot of great opponents like Patera and whatnot. Here's what Backlund had to say in his book about the angle, and I wish this was a YouTube comment because this is very well put. Quote, "So Bruno came up with what was, perhaps, the greatest single angle in the history of professional wrestling. It was, of course, a tale as old as time, an angle with its roots in the biblical story of Jesus and Judas, and summed up in a single word, betrayal." That's some good stuff there from Backlund, and I recommend definitely checking out his book, and hopefully I'll get around to finishing my highlights series on Backlund's book, of which I've done three parts on the blog at section309.com. I forget where I left off. I think it was probably around 1979. But I should get back to more of the stuff on the blog. I've been doing a Saturday night's main event, event by event, starting, of course, in 85, and I'm up at the Mega Powers split, and there's something about that where I'm afraid to really delve into that. Like, I have to do the Mega Powers thing justice. And I hope here today I've done the Bruno Larry thing justice in kind of explaining all that went into that great angle. But without any further ado, it's now time for YouTube comment theater. Pete Pingle says, Now, this is how you make a heel and build an angle for the ages. It was slowly built up over the weeks leading up to the match, with heartfelt interviews from both sides that the fans could understand and be emotionally into. The father figure slash mentor not wanting to step into the ring with his beloved student, and the student just wanting to step out of the shadow of his legendary teacher and prove himself. And the match itself, with the frustration of Zbyszko slowly building until... Outstanding. Collector, thank you for this. And yes, thank you to the Wrestling Collector for uploading what he could of this episode. As I said, the Hulk Hogan match and the Bobby Duncan matches were blocked, but those are the breaks. Jerger918 says, McManikin in the canary yellow sports jacket, FTW. Yeah, Vince McMahon with his ABC Sports look here. Like I always say, the Howard Cosell gimmick that he was going at this time. He was a lot more serious on this show. I saw he brought his A game, I think, here. Paul Trigo says, the San Martino-Zbyszko feud was masterfully done. You don't see that anymore because there isn't enough time to do it that way anymore. It's all about setting up for the next pay-per-view. Well, there's a way they could do it. I mean, they have monthly pay-per-views, but the way they could do it with the size of their roster is just organically take stuff and spread it over 8 weeks instead of four. That might work pretty well. Robert Lofgren has some love for Stoneham's native son, Fred Marzino. Fred Marzino did the best bumps out of any jobber. Well, I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, he's just kind of a guy. John Clark wants to point out something here. Never saw a more obvious blade job than what Bruno did here. I believe he cut himself twice. You even see him tuck the blade into his trunks when he's belly down on the canvas. And yeah, you are probably wondering why Bruno is adjusting his trunks as he's bleeding profusely from the head. It's kind of an odd look there. Giants8691 says, before Hogan joined the Outsiders, this was the biggest unexpected heel turn in wrestling history. And yes, this was a shocking one, and probably was for David Yerger here. When I was a teenager, I actually attended this show with my father 36 years ago in Allentown when it was taped. You are the best, Wrestling Collector. So yeah, somebody who was actually there live, although, well, you know, nobody ever lies in the YouTube comments. Apparently I commented. I'm reading one of my own comments from 6 months ago. Wow, the stretcher got used twice in this episode. Yep, we had Marzino and Bruno Sammartino stretchered out. Which, just opposite ends of the wrestling spectrum on that one. Captain Rhino 1, real heel fan. Awesome to see Zbyszko turn on Bruno and bust him open. Wow, okay. Jonathan Turbide says, booking Patterson as the referee in the Backlund-Patera match was brilliant since it led to a match between Pat and Patera. WWF was very creative at that time. Yes, it's always good booking when you're able to work the next angle while the current angle is still going on. For some reason, my mind always goes to Ted DiBiase with that. But at WrestleMania 5, you have him kind of working his way into the Andre-Jake match. And then at WrestleMania 6, when the Jake angle ends with that match, he ends up sneak attacking the Big Boss Man because they had the little brouhaha on the Brother Love show where he tried to pay off the Boss Man and Big Boss Man would have none of it. I really like when they do that. And finally, from Burger King here, Johnny Rods, a touch as nails heel who never got his rise in the WWWF. In this match versus Tony Mr. USA Atlas, Johnny more than holds his own, practically owning the heavily muscled Atlas for a good portion of the match. Of course, he loses in the end, as he did in most matches against the top talent, but to dish out the huge amount of punishment on Atlas is remarkable. I would have loved to watch Rods, for once, beat a guy like Atlas and send shockwaves through the WWWF. But that's not how he was used. There's one thing I want to correct there. The third W in the Worldwide Wrestling Federation was actually dropped well before this time period in 1980. It was dropped, there's no specific date on when they dropped the extra W, get the W out. There was no campaign like that. It was around March or April of 1979 where they dropped it. And the reason that I've read that they did that was, well, we already know that the world is wide, so why do we need to have the world wide in there? So just World Wrestling Federation. I do remember 15 years ago when they lost the rights to use WWF in England, and you had that whole legal case there with the World Wildlife Fund. I actually thought that they were going to go back to the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. I don't know why I thought that they were going to turn back the clock in that way, and instead they go to WWE. And I just remember at that time feeling like something was really, really lost when they had to change the name of the company. And I know a lot of other people felt that way as well. And that'll do it for this week's show. I've done enough stalling on this show. And I said earlier that this was might be the shortest show that I would do since there were a couple of matches cut. But there was a lot of stuff to get to in the Bruno Larry build. And we're at an hour and 50 minutes. And I know that a lot of people like really, really long podcasts. You see out there 6-hour podcasts. There's no way in hell I'd be able to do that. That's why I like to do these 1-hour shows so that I'm somewhat limited. And an hour and 51 minutes now is not exactly my plan going in to do this podcast. But in any event, I have an idea for next week. And we're going to be going back to the Richard Land catalog. And I'm not sure which episode out of the lot I am going to be doing. Stay tuned to YouTube for that. And also, stay tuned to Twitter for that. And also stay tuned to the Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. I may put up a poll for a future show. I kind of tested the waters a little bit with the ECW thing, but I would kind of like to maybe have some listener participation in picking a future show down the road. But for next week, we're at the beginning of the 1980s, and next week, let's shoot right to the end of the 1980s, as there are a series of shows, superstars, from 1989, in the month of June, that I am looking at, either June 3rd, June 10th, or June 17th. They're all up on Richard Land's channel at this time. It's going to be one of those shows. And what you'll see on that show is that is the month that No Holds Barred came out in theaters. So there's going to be some No Holds Barred talk. And there's probably going to be a clip showed. I know that on the June 3rd show, they aired a clip of No Holds Barred and on one of the other ones. And, of course, all the promotion that went into that. And there's a vignette for a talent. The American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, is making his way to the World Wrestling Federation. He's doing some rather interesting vignettes that might be intended to make him look bad, but Dusty being Dusty, he pulls him off like like crazy. So be taking a look at that, and depending on the show, you know, whoever will be in action. So do tune in next week for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Wrestling skill, that's the name of the game.